okay? Welcome back to Rosie on the House, broadcasting from the Chart Hall Museum. And this segment we have Dr. Sandy Lynch. She's a curator of anthropology here at the museum. Good morning, Dr. Sandy. How are you?
Good morning. I'm terrific. Good. It's a terrific day.
It is a perfect bluebird day out there. There's not a stroke of wind. The sun is full blown. The temperature started out at 53 when I got in the car this morning. But I think the high today is going to be what, Ken?
About 75.
75. Perfect day to get up off that desert floor. Come on up and visit the folk
music festival.
Thank you. That was a full thing this morning. So I wanted to talk to Dr. Sandy because you have just a real, you've been here 20 years.
20 years.
Tell me how you landed here. So you have a doctor of anthropology, right?
Yes. I was walking through the Department of Geology in one of the colleges and universities I taught at in California, and this lady handed me this notice saying, these people are looking for an anthropologist, and I truly was practicing resume writing, and I made the short list and been here since then.
And you said you had family here, so it wasn't a huge...
There's friends and family all over Arizona, so like I mentioned, I wasn't moving to a foreign country.
Right, right. And so tell us, what does that word anthropology cover?
Well, anthro are humans, and pology is the study of. And anthropology is a college discipline, is basically has many prongs on it, but the primary ones are cultural, prehistoric, which is a study of people that don't tell you much but don't lie, and then other things like linguistics. And in some ways, more and more, we're becoming people that are plugged into things like biology and other organic systems. So because the people can't really tell you what their lives, we have to become really good interpreters of what their life was all about. What did they have to work with to develop this culture, to develop this civilization? Or what didn't they have so they didn't take that corner? So that's a little, if I stood on one foot and gave you an answer, that's about it.
That's your elevator speech.
That's my elevator speech.
Yeah.
Well said.
Well, I think from the little time I've had to get to know you, that you're a person that makes things happen. There is something you've created, the fine art market. For
right. We do this long live now, Prescott Indian Art Market, which kind of started with a director at the time that knew that I had a lot of relatives that I used to go hang out at markets and carry their moccasins and baubles, bangles, and beads. And he said, you know, Lynch, I think we'll do an art market here. And he says, how many Indians can you squeeze on the lawns? And I said, about 80. And so we started
that's
that
on the
way.
Lawn here at Charlotte Hall.
Right here. So we started bringing them in, and gosh, two things happened that went well. We had big crowds. We were in the black, and the Indian artists were loved with the reception they had here in Prescott. They loved the people here, and some very, very high-end, fabulous artists that are really hard, that don't leave home and have their own galleries, said, this is the way it used to be when markets were fun, before they
markets
were commercial.
Markets were fun. And if the Arizona listeners wanted to plan on seeing that market this year, it's traditionally the second weekend of July.
Always the second full weekend in July.
Okay.
Correct.
July 14 and 15.
Okay, great.
That's this year.
Thanks,
yeah.
Ken.
Coming in. Thank you.
Yeah. So that idea started on a napkin, I'm told.
Yeah, well, what happened was when I didn't know a darn thing about how to do a show, but I knew an awful lot about what I didn't like about going to them. And so I sat down with about four good American Indian artists and said, hey, this is an opportunity to do it our way. What would you like to do? So the first thing out of the door was, you know, we're juried and looked at a whole lot. What if we had American Indians take over that part? And that's what essentially happened.
That is so great. So now you have this other thing. I don't know if it started on a napkin or not, but you have a project planned here for Chart Hall on the grounds themselves. You want to tell us about that?
It's a bar napkin too.
Is it? Okay. I have a lot of bar napkins, but they haven't turned into such fabulous
things.
There are
people that follow me around with files that put these in as I drop the post-its everywhere I go. Well, An ethnobotany garden is basically another kind of exhibit, and the plants and everything that you see, including the organic rock that's in them, are artifacts. Just like if you walk in and you see a gun in a history museum, or you see corn, beans, and squash, it's an American Indian exhibit. But when you're in an, it's kind of an immersive exhibit, and if you do it right, you can learn so much as a scientist from the experiment that you create in creating an ethnobotany garden about how prehistoric people worked out problems, like Steve, trying to see if something got to grow and why it grew. And not only that, that's what ethnobotany is. It's a relationship between plants and people. And so that's kind of a summation on how that starts. And by studying that relationship, you can tell how far people are going to get with that system. If they develop something like, as we know it, corn, it allows them not to be hunter-gatherers anymore, and they can become sedentism. And when that happens, big things can start happening to culture. So that's if you get that little germ of what an ethnobotany garden is, and you have a lot of land, you have a garden like that.
So Ken, help us describe that, what that's going to look like in the end. We kind of walked it last night. There's right now it's kind of an area where there's a lot of concrete,
yes.
And kind of disjointed, really.
Yes,
but you're going to finish it out in this wonderful.
Right. What will end up happening is that as you get closer and closer down the walkway, you'll see off to your right the Corn Maiden, and that's a bronze sculpture that Sandy can tell you about in a moment, but that'll be on the right, and it'll be kind of a highlight of going through, and all of the plants that will be there are the native plants that were here 100, 200, 500 years ago to try and recreate what was the plants, the flora and fauna that the settlers found when they were coming here for the very first time. You'll also see what we like to describe as Sandy's Hill, but it's actually the petroglyphs from this area that the native peoples had done here thousands of years ago. And this will be part of the full culture of and integrate their history into our history as well.
And the story behind that was that those beautiful petroglyphs were part of a building site, right? And,
yes.
And somehow y'all got word that they were just going to roll them into the dirt.
Yeah, they were. It was part of a land development. Now, this is going back a long time ago, but it was still, there was a development planned, and they were going to just fill the holes and put dirt on top of them, bury them, and build houses on top of them. And we found out about it, or the museum found out about it, and I know that Sandy was very instrumental in saving a lot of those rocks and putting this hill together. She virtually hand-sculpted that. She had other people doing it. If you saw Sandy.
Good directing, yeah.
My reaction on my face, exactly. It does kind of look like a bump in the sidewalk right now, but what you would call what the world gives you, what nature can give you, takes a little while for it to really develop. But the dating on this goes back a long time, and I think what it pulls together here, a lot of people don't know, Granite Mountain is 1 billion years old, and you don't have a lot of 1 billion-year-old rock anywhere in the world. And so the foundation of that bump in the hill looks really strange. It's got smoke-covered black rock, and into that we embedded 19... bedrock petroglyphs, which we're not really sure if they're language that needs their Rosetta Stones. We don't know that. Or if they're art galleries. So what better way than take these petroglyphs to tell the story of human survival? And so that's why that little bump in the yard right now got its start, because we sure didn't want to move any more of those big black granite boulders.
No, it's amazing to look at. Right now there's a little fence around it to keep kids from probably clambering all over it. But
right.
I've seen petroglyphs. We spend a lot of time outside, but they are really very well preserved.
Yes,
and you
are.
Get right up close to them and you can really see. And you find yourself right away trying to decide, What's that saying? You're looking
exactly
for the meaning.
They are, and that's art. Art tells you something. It has a visceral, it's just like American Indian art. It has a visceral response inside. Good art tells you this. Art that's going to last 1 million years is like that. It resonates with what's in your gut and your spirit. So even though you're not a person that created it and knows what the true meaning of it is, it still creates a feeling and it's evocative. So that's the heart, if you will, of this ethnobotany garden and where we wanted to go with it. And there's another reason to do this, too. This is probably one of the places in the yard, and we're talking a four-acre yard here, that Steve had to turn the water off for these to make it. And so look at the lesson that alone can teach you, because water is going to get scarcer, and at least for an awfully long time, the way we've studied drought over the centuries of the earth, we go through these cycles, and human life is very fleeting. We might, you know, get an 80-year run, and the next 80 years is not going to be like it is now. But by using native plants that have weathered the storm for thousands of years, it gives us a clue of how we might want to landscape our lives in the future, what plants we'll have to use.
Where will you get all these plants?
Steve, he's a Mr. Wizard on all of this. He has connections just like I blackmail relatives into doing the Indian market. He has a lot of friends out there that he does some horse trading with.
I think he's going to come in and tell us. You got some.
Yes, I am.
There you go. So how are you going to find those plants?
Well, there's several native nurseries around. We have a native nursery here in Prescott.
Okay.
There's one over in Cottonwood. There's other places around. I mean, I can find the natives.
Yeah.
So it's not a problem.
Okay.
And the tricky part on some of these natives, and we've got really good plant botanists that can tell us what this plant needs. Like manzanita, for example, you don't just pick up a piece, dig out a root or two, and bring it over, because its whole life depends on a community that's plugged into a delivery system through the roots. So what you get may not have a cousin next door that can supply the vitamin it needs. And so manzanita transplanting is like really tricky. So, but Steve.
Yeah, and
Steve,
I've tried it and didn't have any luck.
But we're,
I always
we're
wonder about that, because it's very, you never see it stand alone. It is forest of manzanita.
It is.
It's beautiful.
And it has this underground transport system to get everything that it needs, from water to minerals to everything else. And that's why it's in the darndest areas. And you have to transplant the community.
Pretty much, yeah.
So
that's one of your, that's one of your challenges?
Yes.
Yeah, in fact, the man who actually designed the ethno garden, he said he was pretty good at, you know, keeping manzanita alive. So I'm going to rely on him for our specimens.
All right. So how many different specimens do you think you'll have?
Well, the Yavapai Prescott Indian tribe gave us a plant list of things that their elders had told them they used, you know, and it's 40 strong and growing. But the primary, and first of all, a lot of these plants, when we have fences around things, it's because they're saber-toothed plants, okay? And you don't want a child to fall into a prickly pear cactus farm here. So the fencing is not so much to preserve the ethnobotany garden as to not kill visitors, okay, so going around. But it is a rather remarkable plant list that they gave us. But the number one plant that we know here, and I put this one because they were probably getting short on time maybe, was the fantastic story of agave, or this plant that the Yavapais call the essential carbohydrate Vial.
Let's come back and start. We have one more segment left to visit with you, and let's go ahead and take our commercial break and come back, and you can tell your story all one chunk.
Got it.
All right. Hang on.